Welcome to Footnotes of History, the podcast that whisks you away to foreign and exotic lands to sample the delights that lay within. With you as always are myself, Daniel Nesbitt, and the man for whom I think we can safely say the mysteries of the Orient are no mysteries to him, Tim Philpott.
Thanks, Dan. Well, okay. I think you were going to say my name then. Yeah, today's episode is going to be on the First Opium War, or as we like to call it, the War for Drugs. not quite like that. But I think we should dive straight in.
Yeah.
Actually, no, let's not dive straight in. We should probably just talk slightly about why this is important. Because obviously, up until this point, it's sort of a watershed moment for quite a lot of Eastern economies, in the sense that the sort of imperial powers of Europe are obviously seeking Far Eastern markets, mm-hmm. and up until this point, they've essentially been blocked from getting them.
Yeah, this is the sort of moment. Importing the Chinese goods, but not being able to get any sort of
good
of their own to sell back to them.
Yeah, exactly. Which you know, for national prestige is something quite embarrassing.
I
think it's the tea element of which I'm drinking a mug of right now, which is so sort of pivotal to this. The ludicrous demand for tea in Europe means that basically traders are sort of selling anything they can get a hold of to get a hold of this tea and then bring it back to European consumers.
I think it's probably important to point out we're going to be talking mainly about the period late 1830s into 1840s at the moment. So the war itself is between 1839 and 1842. So earlier end of the 19th century is where we are today, isn't it?
I was going to say we've moved forward a bit from where we were previously.
Yeah.
We were sort of sitting in a sort of sweet spot between the 50s and the 60s, but now we've moved a bit further forward. Yeah. Sorry.
And do you want to quickly talk a little bit about what's going on in the world, just give people a bit of perspective on
Absolutely. In terms of the world context, the 1830s, 1840s, France has sort of undergone a second revolution, and is now under the Duc d'Orléans, the Orleanist monarchy under Louis Philippe. It's not really strictly relevant.
It's not relevant. It's giving it,
but it's more of a
kind of some liberalizing going on around in many areas. I suppose.
Yeah,
and it's like the slave trade being abolished. In British colonies.
As we were going to say, the Great Trek is underway. The same period. Kind of. Russia is becoming more sort of assertive. Back in Britain, it's sort of moving from. So it's at the very end of the weird sort of the transformation between the Tories into the Conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
So Peel is coming into prominence as a major player in the political scene.
Yeah.
And obviously, as we know, he repealed the Corn Laws. Very sort of quite friendly to free trade,
mm-hmm.
and I think that sort of epitomizes the period. This is considered a act of free trade.
Yeah,
this sort of we're kind bullying of like
almost,
China,
almost exactly in the ITV Victoria series era at the moment, aren't we?
Is that right?
Queen Victoria being new to the throne.
Yeah, indeed.
So I mean, that's kind of the context in a very brief. Quite an informative way in many ways.
I think exactly. And also, it's quite important to remember also that in terms of like non-political events, there's a couple of things. So in 1833, the Great Reform Act passed in Britain. So there's more people are able to vote, and the democracy has a
Which
sort
gonna
of...
It's going
to
automatically get MPs thinking a bit more, isn't it?
Yeah, about wider issues rather than just sort of niche things.
Yeah.
And also, it also, again, inspired this idea of the government being for the general welfare rather than just sort of existing for, I don't know,
people in it.
Protecting people or whatever. This is a different way of thinking about government anyway. And then obviously the Industrial Revolution is continuing apace with Brunel launching Archimedes in 1838, which is the first steamship. And then, you know, steamships and ironclad ships are sort of moving on apace, mm-hmm. as well, which will segue quite neatly into our explanations for why Britain did so well in China.
And should we move on and talk a little bit about China as well? So we've had a better European perspective about what's going on, so we talk a little bit about China. Mm. So I think it's quite interesting. I mean, we've spoken a little bit about Japan in previous episodes, and I think there's some similarities between it, and definitely in terms of the sort of mistrust of outsiders that they have, and they're wanting to keep a kind of rigorous control on exactly how many are let in and what they're given and what they can trade in.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of fair to say that they were... not as insular as Japanese, because there were people, outward-looking Chinese people there looking at the world, and there were people being allowed in to trade.
Which there are similarities in the sense that obviously the emperor, well, both the emperor in Japan and the emperor, I mean, obviously this is 20 years later in Japan, mm-hmm. but in the emperor in China and the emperor in Japan, it's very much like they're considered God's representative on Earth.
Yeah.
So anything that interferes with them being absolutely in power mm-hmm. is obviously a danger to the regime. Would that, do you think that's quite part of their suspicion of outsiders?
I think so, potentially, yeah, because they could dilute the control that the Emperor has over things, and when the system they set up, he has quite a firm hold on what's going on in his provinces, but as soon as you start introducing people who are from other countries and are kind of beyond his power, then you can do get that kind of worrying situation for, imagine, the centralized Chinese government.
Essentially, the Chinese society obviously is like... it's very, very similar to a medieval type society. Mm. So essentially, they have the three or four different class strata, social strata, mm-hmm. with the peasants being obviously the lowest of the low, subsistence level. It's very, I think I would say very, very level, similar to a very highly developed medieval
society. It does sound that way, and almost like, I think, as we were talking about in Japan as well, the pyramid society, the emperor at the very top, and then, as you just said, different stratas going down and down until broadening out, but also getting less wealthy or less influential.
Absolutely, yeah. So obviously, the emperor at the top, then below him, sort of imperial-sponsored bureaucrats or scholars mm-hmm. who are sort of, essentially almost monks or church priests of the regime kind of thing. They interpreted the will of the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And then below that, skilled sort of artisans that produced niche luxury goods.
Mm-hmm.
And then below that, peasants. But then even below that, you have like the merchant classes, which are considered to be sort of they're seen as middlemen, but it's like...
they don't create everything their own.
Yeah, they're considered superfluous in a sense, because they're just moving things between people. Mm-hmm.
They don't leave it like a conscious mark on society. Yeah, they just move stuff around. Kind of like how we think of stockbrokers and
exactly. bankers
now in some ways.
Which you can argue that how you like, but that's how they thought of them. Mm-hmm. So they weren't considered very important. It wasn't, trade was not a priority in any way. I was wondering if you wanted to go into how they treated merchants.
Okay, so in terms of looking in foreign trade, the system they had in place is called the Canton system.
Yeah.
This is named after the one port that Westerns were allowed to come into to trade their goods, and it's in southern China.
Yeah.
And there were very strict rules in terms of what Westerners could do. So they could only be there at certain times of the year, certain lengths of time. They're prohibited from bringing their families, because the Chinese didn't really want them to actually establish any links or put any roots in the system.
Or integrate
anyway. And they weren't allowed to learn Chinese either, so they had to do anything through interpreters. Again, nothing to stop getting a foothold and going outside the system, perhaps. And the government strictly supervised merchants in terms of how the Westerners were treated. So they had a system called the Kohong, which is kind of almost like a cabal of Chinese merchants who would deal with the Westerners.
They would move the goods on throughout them.
So it was kind of like a layer to get through.
Yeah. And they were sort of like, they supervised literally everything that happened in there.
Yeah.
I think as well, the reason why they had the Canton system, I don't know if you, we're going to mention this, but I'll go into it anyway, but it's because there used to be a sort of wider system of the merchant class, the Kohong, who would be supervising all the ports, and they had they had special privileges from the emperor to collect the taxes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much abuse of the system because they're obviously so independent.
Yeah.
But the emperor sort of realized that this wasn't really working for him,
mm-hmm.
So decided to ban it and then move them all into one place.
And I think the other interesting is like it was impossible for Westerners to speak directly to government officials. So it's another thing of if they, just to make sure that they don't feel at home here, and if there was an issue they can't resolve it themselves, they have to go through another Chinese person, the person they have the issue with, to get to any sort of authority.
Yeah.
I think it sort of
epitomizes their idea of the foreigners as are barbarian.
Yeah, and I think it is all themed towards making sure that they don't have any sort of real foothold in China, if that makes sense. And it's more towards to point out the time I think partially because it would cost so much to actually get to China from the West.
Yeah,
a lot of the trade is done through, most of the trade is done through companies, so things like the British East India Company, which is probably one of the most powerful corporations ever to exist in the world.
Well, it was state-sponsored as well.
Yeah, it was,
time,
yeah, yeah.
And had a monopoly.
So you had people like the British East India Company, Dutch East India Company as well, and then French and American companies coming in as well.
Yeah.
And I think, should we talk a little bit about what they were actually trading in?
You
touched on it before with the tea, going into it, just sort of showing the scale of exactly how much they were bringing out China. So in 1700, so going back a few, back to the previous century.
Yeah, because it was a sort of like, it's like a sort of an insatiable appetite for
really
Chinese
was.
Goods, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was.
As you said, like, as we said, like, Chinese society is quite, they're sort of like, they've got all this, well, mainly because of the geographical distance mm-hmm. between the two places, like, stuff that is available freely, you know, it's readily available in China, it's just not in Britain.
Yeah, And there's just such a, I think also that you get these, like, throughout history, almost growing, you have this sort of Orientalism around, like, sort of that mystery of the East, it's very popular. You get in late 1900s, you get like reproductions of Chinese furniture and stuff like that. But this is almost like the first wave of it. So in the 1700s, so going back about 100 years, just over 100 years, there was 92,000 pounds of tea exported to Britain alone in terms of tea.
Yeah.
This rose really rapidly. So by 1751, 2.7 million pounds of tea was being exported annually. And then by the time we get to 1800, it's 23 million pounds of tea a year is going back to Britain.
Yeah.
This is around 3.6 million pounds of silver in terms of what the British were paying for it.
Right. It's very difficult to understand how much money that is, I suppose.
It's a pound, a pillage pound of silver is like the weight of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a large chunk.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Especially, I think, also kind of worryingly for the British in terms of thinking for a country that didn't actually have any access to its own silver.
Yeah.
So elsewhere.
Indeed, yeah. Especially in
terms of... So it's not like Portugal or Spain, which have these mines in the New World.
Yeah.
What they term as the New World for silver. And it's Britain's having to go and get the silver from somewhere and then send it over to China.
Yeah,
So I think from, as you've said, they were looking for something to almost balance the books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Send back.
Again, as we mentioned in the episode on Japan, the view was very much like, well, we can't have a deficit because that means we're giving China our silver. Whereas, I mean, ideally you'd be in a situation... I mean, you've got to remember that basically they were sort of thinking of it in the sense that having more silver in your coffers or more gold in your coffers was seen as, oh, you are a superior country somehow.
Yeah.
So to be losing it, sort of reducing it, as it were, to China is a negative.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas obviously, you know, British citizens obviously want this tea. I mean, you know, it's just a ludicrous amount of tea going across.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's any scarcity of... But yeah, no, I can see what you mean. So they're sort of desperate for something to put in the place of the silver that the Chinese would want to trade the tea with.
Yeah, and I think they...
Or not just tea, but like silk and porcelain and other...
Yeah,
other
all
goods.
This like just huge amounts of
stuff.
You know, exotic things that British seem to love, British consumers love.
Yeah. But I mean, I think one of, sorry, busting again. But the one of the main problems they had as well is that because Chinese society was the way it was, people refer to it as well-developed, but it's essentially a well-developed pre-industrial society.
Yeah.
So they got no use for like capital goods, like tools or like, you know, pieces of machinery that they're building in Britain now in terms of, you know, part of the Industrial Revolution, that kind of stuff. So all the stuff that Britain is building in that kind of sense is sort of irrelevant to China. It doesn't really, like, no one has any use for it. In terms of luxury goods, all they've got is stuff that they got from elsewhere, like as we were sort of... so things like processed goods like machine cut cotton cloth, furs and clocks apparently.
Well, I imagine they were kind of the
Exactly. But those are the only things that they were buying. So I suppose
not everyone's going to want those.
Yeah, like, exactly.
You can't really rebalance out.
Yeah, and why would you need a clock if you're a peasant?
Exactly.
So I guess that's where opium.
Yeah, and so opium is basically the product the British find that is actually, one, has a massive demand in China, and two, they can actually make effectively. So opium, in terms of Britain, is basically, it's produced in India.
Hmm.
So the British East India Company will have, like, because it's so powerful, has both the fields that they grow the poppies and things in. Then they also have the shipping routes to get it to China. And
plus, it's important to note as well. It's you're not allowed as a British colony. You're not allowed to trade with anybody except for the mother country.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Do you remember? Yeah. So all this chat about free trade. So basically, they have to trade with Britain first,
and then
Britain has to trade with whoever, with China.
Yeah, and so I think just looking at one of the reasons it was so successful is there was such a high demand for it in China, and just looking at the figures that they're exporting, it's just vast. So they would export it in. It would be exported in chests, which one chest held around 140 pounds of opium.
That's ludicrous.
Yeah.
I don't know how much opium you're supposed to smoke.
Well, that's more than one person needs.
Yeah, I would assume. I have no idea.
So in 1773, when it was kind of like in its embryonic phases, the trade, they were exporting around 1,000 chests a year. So that's quite a hefty amount still. Yeah. But then by 1828, so early on in
the 18th century, about 10 years before the war.
Yeah, 10 years before, it's risen to 18,000 chests a year. Mm-hmm. And then 1839, so on the cusp of the war itself, it's risen to 40,000 chests a year.
That's insane.
So that's, you know, in just over 10 years, it's more than doubled. And so it's just literally flooding into China.
And I don't know if you want to carry on, because I can see your list of figures there.
It just grows. And as we know, we have the war, and then by the late 1800s, so 1884, it's 81,000 chests. Again, just over 20 or 20, 30 years, it's double again.
See, mad stuff.
And it's an interesting one, because the Chinese did smoke it beforehand, and it was quite beforehand, but what the British and what the Eastern Company managed to do is managed to produce strains that were a lot stronger than usual.
Right.
Or more stronger than what the Chinese had originally had.
Yeah.
And then also the Chinese gradually began smoking rather than eating it.
Right.
Which gave them a bigger high, a more powerful high.
Yeah.
Which was again more disruptive for, more worrying as if you're a Chinese official looking at what's coming in.
I suppose so, yeah. I mean it is
I think you're talking a little bit about how the process worked. So, I mean, Chinese, it was not illegal trade.
Yeah.
It was illegal.
If you're thinking about it in terms of strength, I suppose that's actually, it's sort of like an increase in the quality of the product. Because you've got to buy less of it to get a bigger high.
You do.
I'm not.
I think you can also, from the same batch, you can sell to more people.
But obviously from a Chinese Mandarin perspective, this is not good for the morals dangerous. Of society. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, if it's more powerful high, you're putting someone out of action
longer. Yeah.
Allegedly.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Like, it's very difficult to not take a position on this, isn't it?
So what happened was, as it was an illegal trade, it had to be smuggled into China.
Yeah.
So it would be transported to an island, so that there was kind of equidistant between Canton, which was where the Western traders was, Hong Kong, which was a port on the coast, and Macau, which was a Portuguese sort of held area enclave. It was put onto an island, and then it was then sort of divided up amongst Chinese smugglers, who would then take it into the mainland, then utilised the sort of river networks that China had. So it's something we'll come into later in the war, but they had very, quite highly developed networks in terms of rivers getting to cities. And then from there, it was kind of just like diffused into the population at large from there.
I don't know whether we mention this, but Canton obviously is up a river. It's almost a mainland, but it's on a river.
Yeah.
So it's not on the coast.
So by doing it in an island off slightly up river from it, then that way you can also get around the authorities who are trying to stop you getting your stuff in.
Yeah.
And just talking about the scale, the amount of opium that's going into China at this point is high.
Yeah.
And then, but the amount of people who are addicted to it and using it regularly is also incredibly high. So by the 1830s, it's estimated that around 90% of young males on Chinese East Coast, so that's where drugs are coming in the first place, 90% of Chinese young males were addicted to it. So this is literally the part of the population you're looking to actually be productive.
Yeah.
Are addicted to opium in some way, or at least regularly using it.
Yeah.
And then also, if you look amongst the higher echelons of society, so government officials, 20% of those are using it, so quite a hefty proportion.
Yeah.
But also local officials, 30%. So people who are collecting your tax revenue, or overseeing what's happening, 30% of them are addicted to it. And then also the emperor himself, and a large number of courtiers were also regularly using it.
Yeah.
But also I think potentially most worryingly in terms of in some minds of China, large numbers of the armed forces were using it too. So the officer class were using it, people who were looking to for actually soldiers were using it.
Yeah.
And this kind of conjured up concerns amongst the Chinese in terms of how they're actually going to defend themselves if they're attacked.
I was wondering whether, because obviously it's an illegal trade.
Yeah.
But the demand for it was this, this luxury item, something that, it's this sort of rich pastime, basically, smoking opium.
Yeah.
Obviously there's the moral issue of them thinking, this is bad for society, blah, 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 it's like moral decay, blah, blah, blah. But also, they're obviously kind of missing out on the customs duty.
Well, this is quite an interesting thing, actually, because before, you know, I think in sort of popular culture now, like with the way people think of the war now, is that Britain forced China. Like, the Chinese didn't want it at all. And the Britain forced them to open up their market.
It's almost like they sort
of flooded it in.
Yeah, almost like they held them at gunpoint and forced it down their throat.
Which, to an extent, they did, because they were forcing China to open up. But there was a, you know, as we've seen from the figures of people consuming, there's a huge market there. And also, it wasn't as clear-cut as the Chinese court saying, we don't want it. There was for quite a while before the war, before the Chinese started cracking down, there was a debate going on within the court itself about whether we should actually legalise the trade and profit from it or try and clamp down on it. So there was this sort of school of thought in there, especially amongst the
plus
people
also,
who were...
Plus also, I mean, like, if people not like demand it, if they, I mean, people are free to choose what they buy and they don't buy, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to go into
in terms of the factions at court, you had this hardline faction who wanted it, who looked at the army, looked at the looked at the sort of officials who were hooked on it, looked at the population hooked on it and wanting it cracked down.
You also had another
faction which was made up of many southern officials who were sort of on seeing the drugs coming in, seeing the amount of money it was creating, how valuable the trade was, and how much was being missed out on, and also the merchant class as well.
Oh, really?
Who were very pro at legalizing it and taxing it.
So
you had this thing that going on between the two sides, and the emperor kind of swayed between the two for a while, and eventually then came down on the anti-opium side and said, we need to do something about it.
Yeah. Despite having smoked it himself.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing, which I never really knew.
Well, I think it might be, you know, it's sort of like a snobbery type thing. It's like, we shouldn't be allowed to smoke this if you're not the actual emperor.
Yeah.
I was going to say as well, it's interesting what you said about opening up, for Britain, obviously, opening up. This is like almost the period of free trade. This is like the new imperialism, as we were saying earlier. You're not conquering something to keep control of the territory. You're conquering it for the market.
And this is like is almost like one step more removed. You're not conquering it. You're forcing the market to be there, and basically you're leaving all the power structures in place, but you're opening up to your trade,
your goods, and whatever you want to.
And so, so we've got to this point where there's an issue for Britain in that they're bringing loads of Chinese goods in, and that they can't really get anything back.
Yeah,
they're their own way. So they've got opium. Yeah. They're having success in getting that through.
Yeah.
And getting money from it.
Yeah,
now the Chinese
have
got to the point where they're getting a bit sick of the fact that Britain are sending all these drugs in, and they're not being able to stop that.
Yeah. And plus also, I think there's also, sorry, I just want to jump in there. There's also the economic factor. The tide has sort of turned in terms of, if you're thinking about it from the, you know, the gold and silver movement perspective, the gold and silver is now actually leaving China.
Yes.
It's
sort
of like,
absolutely.
More money is being spent on opium than the other way around now. So
And this is about, as we said, the emperor's side of the anti-opium faction.
Yeah.
And he kind of looked around for a person to actually go down to the area that's coming in and clamp down on it.
Yeah.
And then so he's alighted on this high-ranking bureaucrat called Lin Zexyu.
Yeah.
And he'd been governor general of a portion of central China, where he'd had part of his sort of rule there had been themed towards cracking down on opium. So he had a background, like a strong sort of background in cracking down it in
the
past.
Kind
of like, you know, when you're looking at a politician, he's got his track record laid out on a certain issue, and he's not strayed from it.
Yeah.
But the emperor met him 19 different times to discuss his sort of
his status and what he would do.
What his plan was.
It's like an interview process.
Yeah, basically.
19 rounds.
He'd also sent a document before. This was made a document on what he wanted to do beforehand.
Okay.
He's quite outward thinking type of guy, because he had begun collecting material to actually start writing a book about the West to disseminate into China.
Yeah.
In the end, he didn't actually have the time to do it, but he gave it to a man called Wei Yuan, who actually wrote the book in the end, which is the first major Chinese work on
the West,
and it's called An Illustrated Treatise on the Maritime Kingdoms. So he very much contributed into that book. Which is quite interesting, because they would have brought... That's where they would have come by sea, and that was, I imagine, there.
It's almost like the first wave of, like, you know, with you in Japan, where they were like, oh, we're going to do Western studies.
Almost. And so he was very much at the forefront of this, and he had a reputation of being dedicated at his work, honest, and also very caring towards the citizens under his charge. So actually, you know, he was actually quite a sound person, I think.
Yeah.
A choice of person on paper to do this.
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, if you're going to... Yeah, I mean, obviously he would be interested in the citizen's moral position, moral status.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you have anything about what he did when he got there?
Well,
he
dispatched? Well, he wrote He was made when he was made the special imperial commissioner with the task of eradicating
opium. So he'd gone down to the area where Canton was.
Exactly.
The sort of southern eastern coast.
And then sent a letter to Queen Victoria saying, what are you doing? This kind of thing. Which is sort of debatable whether it ever arrived.
Yeah, I think I read that it never actually got there, but it was later published in the Times, I think, as kind of like an op-ed almost.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, like a letter to the editor almost. Somehow washed up there.
From Lynn ZXU. Yeah. But yeah, and essentially, so I think the opium trade was essentially, it was like, if it wasn't banned before, it was now super banned.
He had extra
banned.
And
there was a crackdown on...
Yeah, he had an immediate impact. So I think he arrested around 1,700 Chinese opium dealers.
Yeah.
And confiscated 70,000 opium pipes.
Yeah.
In his first few months.
It was burned on the beaches and that.
So at one point, after doing this, he then tried to convince the Western merchants to give up their opium.
Yeah.
And there was kind of back and forth. He invited some merchants to a meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
And then his plan was apparently to execute one of the leading merchants.
Oh, really?
So they didn't actually go because they were warned.
They
were basically warned, don't go, kind of thing.
This is what he's going to do to you.
And then,
it's fair enough, I think.
Then he kind of like, after this back and forth of trying to get out of them willingly, he realized it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So he surrounded the Western enclave with troops.
So basically, the Pearl River was blockaded. The Pearl River leading up to Canton.
Trading port. Basically stopped them in there. What happened was the British superintendent of trade who was there controlling it, basically told anyone who could get onto a ship, any Westerners could get onto a ship, basically get out and get to Hong Kong, I think he sent them to.
Yeah.
And then all the people who left, he placed all Westerners under the protection of the crown.
Oh, really?
to try and stop them being killed.
But once
Lin actually got in there, he confiscated and destroyed 1.2 million kilograms of opium that were being held, as he said. I think he mixed it with lime and salt on the beaches.
Oh, really?
Basically just destroyed it.
Yeah. This was Lin?
Yeah, this was Lin. Yeah.
Because I think Elliot was like, he essentially said, it was like a sort of a... He was trying to keep the peace, basically.
Yeah.
So it was like he sort of offered an amnesty, a sort of compensation, from the British government to traders who had opium.
Yeah.
So like, just destroy your opium because we can't really risk
it. Yeah, we can't do anything about it.
We're going to pay, we'll pay you off.
Yeah.
The British government was like, sorry, what? What have you promised these people? Made it a little bit like, Should we be doing it? As you probably read, it was like, we don't disapprove of your trade, but, we probably need to keep these people happy.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
So that was kind of the Canton sort of incident where it was kind of, I think it's almost like a watershed moment in the debate, because that's where like the first big Chinese movie has been made. He's actually moved on the Westerners and he's forcibly taken their opium from them. And then destroyed it.
Yeah.
There was another incident as well, which kind of happened around the same time.
Yeah.
Is this the Kowloon incident, kind of played into the popular mindset of, or the rising feeling of anti-Western, particularly anti-British mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to go out? Do you want me to?
Feel free to leave. Basically a bar fight.
What happened was there was a group of British and American sailors kind of went on a drunken rampage through or near Kowloon and beat a Chinese man to death.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And then... Chinese authorities demanded that they all get tried in China because they've done some Chinese soil and they killed a Chinese man.
Yeah.
But the British commander of the British ships,
Charles Elliot.
Yeah, so the British authorities refused and tried them on board a ship.
Yeah.
Instead, interestingly, they were all found guilty of the crime they did. Later, when they got back to Britain, they were all kind of quietly, nothing was done about it, but they were found guilty at the time.
Yeah.
Obviously, this wasn't good enough for the Chinese because... essentially foreign citizens coming in, killing someone, and then not facing justice, which is to their mind not right.
Yeah.
Obviously not right. And then kind of the situation escalated in terms of the Chinese then, the British merchants were then told to evacuate any surrounding areas that they were in and went out of the port and into out to sea. And then Chinese ships arrived to stop them coming back in to resupply.
Yeah.
And after kind of like a standoff or on a skirmish, the British eventually just left because they were running out of supplies and couldn't get back to.
Yeah.
The supply.
Yeah.
And so that's the Kowloon.
Yeah, that's the Kowloon.
Which is kind of
the
like,
crisis. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like a next step on. So it's gone beyond the opium at this point.
Yeah.
It's now almost, it's now
an issue of
national pride.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so
yeah.
So at the moment, the Caldwell incident happened in July 1839.
Yes.
And I think from there we can definitely see that things escalate very quickly. So in October 1839, the British Expeditionary Forces ordered to China by Lord Melbourne, Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite important to say at the moment, just looking at the British kind of debates around it, it was a lot closer than I was expecting in terms of
the votes
on the war.
Yeah.
So it was only quite narrowly that the House of Commons voted for war. So it was 271 to 262 in favour. So it wasn't like by any means a sort of foregone conclusion that it would actually
definitely
have the numbers to get to war. So
yeah,
people like Gladstone, later Prime Minister, and literally throughout
he literally existed for the entire period.
And he headed up the anti-war MPs, and they were very despondent about the trade because they're sort of the moral and physical damage it was doing to China.
Yeah,
I think kind of like from a perspective, we should be civilizing these people, not like destroying their civilization kind of thing.
But
in the end, Palmerston, who was the foreign secretary and basically headed the pro-war camp.
That is so classic Palmerston. He's such a war horse.
He is.
It's just unbelievable. Because he was in charge during the Japan war as War of Japan.
And so he very much saw this as kind of a free trade being endangered situation. That he didn't like the fact that China had refused to treat British nations as equals.
But it's just
he was very pro-war, and he issued this list of objectives to the commanders, which was, we won't go into all of them because there was a long list.
Yeah.
He was like, we need to gain most favoured trading status, seek recompense for British property destroyed, make sure we can have British representatives on China mainland, make sure that new ports are opened up, secure an island base for the British off China as well.
Yeah.
So kind of like it was a list of roster demands that the British force had to go out and capture.
Yeah.
And from then on, the force are sent out in 1839,
October 1839.
Now, also, it makes you think, also, because then they had to steam or sail all the way around, so they didn't arrive.
It took them a while to get there. It's like
June 1840 when they arrived.
Along with the newest addition to the Royal
Navy. Yes, yeah. Do you want to quickly talk about the Devil Ship?
Yeah. The Devil Ship is the... It's not referred to as the HMS or the SS. It's called the Nemesis.
Yeah, so I think this is not HMS because it was an East India Company ship, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So they created it, and the government were like, we're going to take this for now.
That's what I mean. It was like obviously designed to be a cargo vessel because it had a shallow draft.
Yeah.
But they obviously kissed it out for war.
Basically. Yeah, well, I think
the first ironclad steam.
Yeah,
navy vessel.
Ironclad steam and sail warship.
Yeah, indeed. Steam and sail. Yeah, of course. So sail is obviously still in vogue at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think there was a comment from one of the officers who said the war would be an extremely favourable offshoot of testing the advantages or otherwise of iron steam vessels.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like almost the mindset the British are going into. It's kind of like, we've got some new tech.
Let's see what's going on.
Let's see how we can deploy it in future.
Yeah.
And so, like, along with the Nemesis, which arrived a little bit later than the advanced guard, when they arrived, there were 48 ships in the British fleet, 16 warships, 4 armed steamers that they got with them, which had been converted.
I can understand why they called, obviously they called the Nemesis the Devil Ship, but
yeah.
I can understand, steamships must have been at the time, it's like, what are these monstrosities that were
ranged against, and something we'll come on to after
it's like Dragon
War. Basically, after we sketch out the war, we'll definitely go on to just how superior the British were in technology.
Yeah.
Along with the warships, they had 27 transport ships and troop ships, and then 4,000 soldiers.
Yeah.
And like just looking at the sort of effort that went into this war on the British side in terms of the supplies they needed, they had 6 million pounds of coal in this advanced fleet alone, plus 16,000 gallons of rum for soldiers.
Of course,
rations. And it kind of shows the resources of the empire being drawn on. So there were ships and troops coming from all over the empire, so you had people come from South Africa,
from India as well.
And it kind of just shows once the empire kind of cranks into gear, where it can deploy troops from.
Yeah,
and I think this probably shows also it wasn't just Britain fighting from one side of the world to China, the other side of the world. It had all these like way stations in between, which helped resupply throughout the war.
Yeah,
and so just really briefly, we'll sketch out what the British strategy was. I think it was kind of like their first objective was to capture port, and from then in
from Canton, you mean?
It wasn't Canton they went to originally. I don't think it was what they chose was a port called Ding Kai, which was on an island off China.
Yeah, yeah.
And from there they captured that and they kind of like spread inland.
Yeah,
so they split into three fleets. One went into the Yellow Sea, which was sort of threatened a bit more of the north.
Yeah.
Then another went into the Pearl River, which was to capture Canton and move in from there. And then another one which went to Pihau, which was to try and basically deliver Palmerston's demands to the high command of the emperor. And like basically what happened was, although the war went on until 1842, I don't think there was ever in much doubt about who was going to win.
Yeah.
Because as the British kind of just like, everywhere they met the Chinese, they just steamrolled them.
Yeah.
And it was only, I think, because the Chinese had more men to draw on that they kept going for so long.
Yeah.
And the British kind of like advanced slow but surely between upriver and further into China using these river system that had been originally used by, you know, for traders and things. They just took advantage of that. They captured town by town, really.
Yeah.
And Sue, should we talk a little bit about why the British won?
Straightforward. Yeah. Well, I think we were going to put the picture on the episode page. It's going to be fun as historio.com/12.
Mm-hmm.
But this is it's referred to as the devil ship, obviously, as we've mentioned.
Yeah, this is the nemesis.
But also, I think that the steamships in general had obviously advantage on rivers because they could go anywhere mm-hmm. without necessarily waiting for the wind.
Because
obviously the Chinese war junks are much more reliant on whatever the weather's doing.
Yeah, and also I think from reading reports of them, they're even less manoeuvrable than Western ships.
Oh, really?
Like they would have to sail in straight lines at British ships, as the British ship would just then fire broadside into them.
Yeah.
And you know, basically every image we have of the war on the water is there's always seems to be a junk just exploding when its magazines hit. And this seems to happen again and again that the British just fire their vastly superior guns into them,
and then
the junks would just be destroyed by the time they even got anywhere near them.
What about the some of the ships had ludicrous numbers of guns on as well.
Yeah, so
it's just so totally unmatched.
I think
it's unbelievable.
Just looking at the British advance units that got there in June 1840, so the very first ones that got there.
Yeah.
They had the 16 warships had 540 cannon between them. So that's a huge amount.
Yeah.
On each ship. And you know, these ships are gonna be bigger, as you said, much more maneuverable than any Chinese ship that they can be sent against them.
Yeah.
I think this also the superiority like isn't just power, it's in the army as well. So the British soldiers that were deployed were all veterans of these wars that have been going on throughout the empire to expand British territory and
I imagine they probably drew upon. I mean, I know it's quite a long time afterwards, I suppose, the Napoleonic Wars, but I suppose this is a sort of a.
But also, for the very least, even though it's only 1815 was when the war ended, so that's another 20 years on ish.
Yeah.
So you're going to have people who were young officers at the time in the Napoleonic Wars, but also you'll have a mindset in the British Army of we are the best in many ways because we have this.
I guess.
We beat
because they won the Napoleon.
We've expanded the empire and now we're being deployed again, kind of thing. So they already have it in going in, they already have confidence to actually do what they need to do. And they had, rifles, cannons, and then in comparison, China had, only half of their soldiers had firearms. And a lot of those were matchlocks. So matchlock is something that the British would have used in the English Civil Wars.
Yeah,
and then
plus also the,
later on.
Yeah.
So this is literally about almost 100 years.
Yeah.
You know, backwards,
I think it was like brown vest muskets as well.
Brown vest, the standard issue
in the Napoleonic Wars.
And so you get to the point where the British infantry.
That's like the height of their.
Yeah. So British infantry can shoot effective range of between 200 and 300 meters against Chinese, which have an effective range of the very most 100.
Wow.
And then in terms of cannon, the Chinese have artillery about 200 years behind the British.
Yeah.
British have much more lighter and maneuverable cannon, so they can just get them on shore and move them around when they need to. The Chinese have to drag them. And then maybe get to the battlefield in time to see their infantry being decimated.
I think it was quite a lot of them. There's quite a lot of sort of anecdotes of the British ships just sort of sitting just out of range of the Chinese port, Chinese fortresses.
And just
bombarding them, without any danger to themselves. Mm-hmm.
And they can maneuver around them. So even though the Chinese have these quite hefty fixed positions of guns, they can't really bring them to bear on the British. The British can either stay out of range or maneuver around their fields of fire.
And
even though the British had about a tenth of the men that the Chinese had deployed, so British had around 20,000 soldiers, whilst the Chinese had 200,000, could call on 800,000. As we said, I don't think it was ever really in doubt about who was going to win because of the technological superiority. And then just look at the list of what happened. So, I mean, they capture Dingai in 1840, they capture Canton in 1841, and then they just carried on until they get closer and closer to the capital. By 1842, they've cut the Grand Canal, which is what the emperor relied on to get his basically mirrors to the country. So the Grand Canal basically linked up. And then this is where they got the tax revenue coming in. This is how he distributed commands. And then the British cut it completely by taking Zhengjing Changing in July 1842, and so they could just sit there and basically interrupt interrupt anything. So I think by 1842, the Chinese really thought the writing's on the wall. We're gonna have to sue for peace here.
Should we go on to the peace?
Yes, I mean,
the treaty of Nanking.
Yes,
was actually quite a big moment, because it was sort of like, did it not also establish Hong Kong? Well, it's the extraterritoriality.
Yeah, so it has like a list clause, of yeah, and it, yeah. Basically, look at Palmerston's list of demands. Yeah. They're kind of replicated here almost in what they got. Okay. So as you said, it's all about a lot about extraterritorialities in there. So, the Kowloon incident and about where the British didn't want to have their citizens to be tried by Chinese courts is kind of put down in black and white, that if a British citizen does commit a crime in China, he's not going to be subject to Chinese law, he's going to be tried in Britain.
Yeah.
Then there are reparations. So
reparations.
So and also debts to British merchants as well. So it's around 21 million taels in Chinese, a vast amount over 3 years.
Yeah.
Britain's given most favoured nation status. So that's if any other treaties that have negotiated with any other power that are better than the clauses of this one, then it will be about to Britain as well.
Yeah.
And formal ports are open to Western trade. The Canton system has ended. It's liberalised in some form. Western trade with China. Forcibly liberalised. And also Hong Kong was ceded to the British. Well, interestingly, my dad was born a few years later than this, obviously.
Yeah. But, 100 years later.
Hong Kong was ceded to the British and eventually returned in 97. No, it was 2000, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was at the millennium they gave it back.
Yeah. But Hong Kong is ludicrous, because just quickly, the unbelievable contrast between mainland China and Hong Kong.
Mm.
I mean, Hong Kong obviously is like remained as a sort of sort of liberal free trade type of port, essentially merchant port for hundreds of years. It's like unbelievable contrast between the wealth in Hong Kong compared to mainland China. Just amazing. But anyway,
this treaty, I think. It was supplemented by the Treaty of the Bogue, which came a bit later and kind of cemented a lot of these clauses. I think the treaty was done in quite a hurry,
right,
and then they needed to work out finer details. So two treaties kind of ended the war on sort of humiliating terms for China, in terms of basically their whole approach to Western trade has been destroyed, done away with, and replaced by something they didn't want.
Yeah, yeah.
They had to pay huge amounts of reparations and debts to British merchants.
Yeah.
And they've had to give away some of their territory, and also British are now going to be able to commit crimes with basic impunity in China.
Yeah.
And this...
there's quite a lot of similarity, obviously, with the Japanese.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're looking down at it, this is exactly what...
This is the generic treatment.
It is, of Eastern Asian nations by imperialist powers. And there's a definite pattern in terms of how they are treated and how the terms that are put upon them.
Yeah.
I think this is sometimes seen as the start of... China's what's called Century of Humiliation,
right,
mainly by Western nations. Yeah. It was the moment where I think, similar to Japan in many ways, that the ruling dynasty had made it a bit weak.
Yeah.
So from then onwards, you had rebellions and uprisings kicking off with more and more regularity, and probably the most destructive was the Taiping Rebellion between 1850 and 1864, which caused between 20 and 30 million deaths in China.
That's ludicrous.
Just horrific circumstances. Yeah, yeah. This,
but what under what circumstances?
I don't know. I think maybe potentially an episode going into it. But I'm imagining disruption, famine, disease spreading, that type of thing.
It's only that kind of thing that caused so many deaths.
So Lin himself suffered quite badly from it, because he was kind of used as a scapegoat by the regime. Yeah. So he was sent to a remote province. to rule over, to administer.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, I think it's basically Siberia, the Russian version of getting sent to Siberia. Chinese version. But he did manage to work his way back to a measure of his previous position.
Yeah.
Again, I think showing the fact that he was actually quite, although he did badly after that, he was actually quite effective. Sent to do in there, but unfortunately, he don't think he really reckoned on the will of the British to not be circumvented.
I guess so.
So I think, this kind of just shows. Basically, it's a complete victory for the British.
Although it started as a sort of trading relationship, it very much became just an extension of sort of imperial power, essentially.
And that's
a bit of a shame, but what can you say?
I think that's basically, I think it's a good place to leave it in terms of that. I mean, we are going to be doing the sequel to this, which, is, of course, if this is with a film world, it'd be China coming back, kind of the underdog coming back, yeah, and having its vengeance kind of thing.
Yeah, the Empire Strikes Back.
Basically, the Empire Strikes Back, but unfortunately, I feel maybe we might know that didn't happen. So we will be covering the second Opium War in a future episode. But do you have any further reading at all?
I do have a few bits and pieces. Do you want to
start? A couple of ones. So there's a very good MIT website called MIT Visualizing Cultures. If you type in MIT Opium Wars, it will come up, MIT Visualizing Cultures. And it's quite a good introduction to the opium trade, the war itself, how it was conducted.
Yeah.
And it's got quite a lot more sources on there. And also
the
Ibis Trilogy by Amitav Ghosh is a historical fiction set in and around the First Opium War.
Yeah.
And kind of gives quite a good, interesting sort of introduction to it, if you want to look at that as well. So they're both quite good areas to explore.
Yeah. I got one that's hot off the press. Off the press. It's supposed to be published in 2019. I know, exactly. Apparently this is all completely new. It's really expensive, but it's really new. released on the 29th of March, The Qing Empire and the Opium War, The Collapse of the Heavenly Dynasty, from the Cambridge China Library. And this is sort of a revisionist, it's definitely not the second look, probably the 90th look at this period and the perceptions of the Opium War on both sides, both countries.
Because presumably that is coming from a Chinese...
Well, I mean, it's
translated in English.
Indeed it is,
It's quite interesting to see the opposite view, because obviously history is written by the victors.
So
it'd be quite good to see more Chinese perspectives.
I suppose there is an aspect of that, isn't there? Mm. I suppose, I mean, we don't really...
I think it's always good, I think rounding off in many ways, I think this sort of incident shows how strong the Western powers were.
I think the industrial revolution and the sort of internal liberalisation, I suppose, of the economy had made them made their militaries extremely powerful compared to other countries.
Absolutely. And I think it just shows another sort of chapter in Western imperialism in Asia. Shows how, likewise with Japan, it's not so much a conquest move, it's a forcibly opening trade move and then extracting money from them, basically, and in humiliating terms. I think, again, it's an interesting way to look at imperialism in a different sense to how we look at it in Africa.
Which is
very much a conquest and then take the
resources.
So the variation on the theme. Get the resources, but you do it in a slightly different way.
And
I think, as I've said, we will be returning to the subject in a few episodes' time with the Second Opium War. Mm-hmm. So join us then.
Indeed. Look out for it.
Thanks for listening to Footnotes of History. For more episodes, visit footnotesofhistory.com and subscribe. Or if you want to suggest an episode to us, email us on episodes@footnotesofhistory.com. You can also follow us on social media at FOH Podcast for Twitter, and we're also on Instagram and YouTube. Thanks for listening.